Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine for the Bay Area Performing Arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week we welcome back members of Word for Word for their fourth appearance on the virtual stage of our Corona Radio Theater Initiative. Actors Cassidy Brown, Artis Fontaine, Sophia Frederick, Gwen Loeb, and David Moore will be reading the 1996 short story, The Appropriation of Cultures, by American writer Percival Everett. In Word for Word co-director Susan Harlow's words, a wickedly subversive story about symbols and their meaning. We'll check in with conductor Martin West and production director Christopher Dennis from the San Francisco Ballet to see how that company is adapting to COVID. And for a change, to start things off, Open Air's regular contributor Peter Robinson is on hand via Zoom to muse on back-to-school plans, including a book review, 25 Great Sentences and How They Got That Way by Geraldine Woods. Help for any student or anyone writing essays, reports, or journals. He'll also share comments from listeners about how music has helped them through the current crisis. Hello, Peter.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here. And indeed, I want to thank listeners who've called me when they feel music has really guided them during this time of they may be in quarantine, they may be in isolation, but they may simply not be in contact. So they turn on the record player in the old days, the radio today, or wherever they get to hear it. And the first recommendation comes from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's the Ode to Joy. And I'll just say one thing about this. If you're used to singing in groups or singing in a choir, you get the feeling of being with people, but you also exude oxygen. You fill your lungs, you let it out, and that's how the virus can catch the person next to you. So with this, it's not me or them singing in groups. It's Ode to Joy. And what a rousing piece of music, which Beethoven wrote in 1824. And today has come to represent Europe. It's been a song for Europe as a way of bringing things together. It also has an interesting history, because the full recital would be 70 minutes, which is the length of a CD. So it's influenced the way CDs are made. And most important to me, it speaks to the spirit of music and to the spirit of voices coming together. So let's hear a snatch of Ode to Joy.
Indeed, it was Sony president at the time that CDs were made that insisted on getting a format for listening that would include the entire Ninth Symphony. That's why a CD is the length it is now. Let's enjoy a chorus from Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth for a moment.
Well, although it sounds different sometimes on the sound on radio, but that really is a rousing piece of music that brings your spirits up. And a second piece, which another listener from this time, North Beach, Carol Goodman, has recommended, may be famous today because it is the opening sequence of Woody Allen's movie Midnight in Paris. But in fact, it goes back to 1951. The clarinetist here is Sidney Bechet. And he, I think, really illustrates to me how he might have had an erratic life on the outside, but put a clarinet in his hands and suddenly we're full of soul. Here we go, Sidney Bechet. Well, that reminds me, and I think music plays a big part in memory. But when I was working at Radio Monaco, once a month I'd do a report from Paris, and I'd use that as the opening theme. You could just imagine yourself sitting in a boulevard cafe along the Champs-Élysées, and suddenly in comes that haunting sound, the daunting sound, which is slow, it's soulful. And I think if you're alone by yourself, as you may be when you're isolated, this reaches, I want to say, parts of the body that words do not get to. The translation that when you see your mother has been sung as a song, but to me it's always going to be Sidney Bechet coming in with that very doleful feeling that you can be alone, but with music you're no longer alone. An enormous feeling, and the way that clarinet speaks to me speaks loud and clear. And the final piece I'm going to be talking about in this first segment is a song, We Shall Overcome, and it takes me back to the protests of the 1960s when the country was divided, and the words speak loud and clear. Now, talking about the way music conjures up memories, and that particular folk song in particular, takes me into my next segment. And it's a great book called 25 Great Sentences. It's written by Geraldine Woods and her subtitle, How They Got That Way. She is the type of teacher I would love to have had in school. She doesn't tell you, you can't do this, don't do that, there's no oughts or shoulds, but she shares these great sentences. And since we've been listening to We Shall Overcome, there is one sentence today which resonates in my ears. And of course, it is that great speech of Martin Luther King, in which he begins, I have a dream. This nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. And then he quotes, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And of course, it's a speech which is based on rhetoric, based on the way that he spoke those words. And then the next four paragraphs continue after that with, I have a dream. So she looks at some of Martin Luther King's speeches in this book, but she actually holds him for his longer ones with the longer sentences. But sometimes I think it's a short sentence that can get your attention. Now, this book is full of great suggestions, great talks, and little bits of history. And I think in terms of political rhetoric, I was pleased to see that she does have the Jack Kennedy speech, which of course is now immortal in people's heads, ask not what you can do for your country, but what your country can do for you. This, of course, came from the 1961 inaugural address. And what she does is raise the issue, can you begin a speech with a question? And again, she explores how this happened. There is many disputes about how Jack Kennedy found that speech, whether he was quoting the headmaster at Choate School or whether Ted Sorensen, who was his speechwriter, put it in there. But it is something which registers today with us, especially at a time when some presidents can't even read off a prompter, let alone create more adjectives than we think is possible in the language. So again, what she does in her book is take a speech. She explores the importance of beginning with a subject, verb, object, very simple, straightforward stuff. And I think anybody writing a journal, anybody having to write an essay at school, this will inspire you to question how you put those words on the page. And she finally goes one stage further and quotes the Neil Armstrong about landing on the moon. And again, there are disputes about this because the recording was faint. A small step, did the A get included there? A giant leap, the comparison. And suddenly you're becoming conscious that words really matter. Words are a key to understanding. And having a great sentence to open with, I think, is one of the clues to putting something down on paper that will resonate with your readers. So I'm going to repeat the book title again. It's called 25 Great Sentences and How They Got There. And anybody, whether they keep a journal, whether they're starting the school year, even if they're doing it at home on home learning, when you pick up that pen and put it down on paper, this book will help you think about the words you're expressing, the order that you put them in, and whether indeed the sound resonates the sense. Many, many different ideas, a really wonderful book, highly recommended. So stay home, pick up that pen, keep a journal, and if you hear a great speech or a great sentence, put it on your computer file, share it with a friend, because we live in an age where talking to each other, even if it's on the telephone, can be an important way of breaking down that isolation when you're alone at home. Over to you, Dave. Here we go.
Thank you so much, Peter, and we'll have a treat of having you 2 weeks in a row. You'll be joining us once again next week to shine your unique light on some of the Bay Area arts scene, and maybe from a Marin perspective as well. Thanks, Peter. Well, later in the hour, I'll be checking in with conductor Martin West and production director Christopher Dennis from the San Francisco Ballet to see how the company is adapting to COVID, along with some very creative videos that they've created in this crisis. But before we do that, I want to remind you that today is California Public Radio Day. It's a special day when stations all across the state are joining together to ask you to show your appreciation for your nonprofit local station. And we hope it's KALW. You can help us celebrate California Public Radio Day by making a donation to KALW right now. The future of public radio in this golden state relies on your support, and you ensure that this public service is here for everyone to enjoy, no matter who can afford to give. Again, you can make that donation now at kalw.org. And now our live Corona Radio Theater segment, actors from Word for Word, perform Percival Everett's The Appropriation of Cultures, directed by Rami Margron, with music by Marcus Shelby. Word for Word's co-director Susan Harlows calls this a wickedly subversive story about symbols and their meaning. In the author's words, since telling the South Carolina State Legislature in 1989 that I couldn't continue my address because of the presence of such a conspicuous sign of exclusion, the Confederate flag, I have not really considered South Carolina.
The Appropriation of Cultures by Percival Everett. Daniel Barclay had money left to him by his mother. He had a house that had been left to him by his mother. He had a degree in American Studies from Brown University that he had in some way earned, but that had not yet earned anything for him. He played a 1940 Martin guitar with a Barkus Berry pickup and drove a 1976 Jensen Interceptor, which he had purchased after his mother's sister had died and left him her money, because she had no children of her own. Daniel didn't work and didn't pretend to need to, spending most of his time reading. Some nights he played music near the campus. Some nights he went to a club near the campus of the University of South Carolina and played jazz
with some old guys who work very hard during the day, but ain't hold Daniel's condition against him. Daniel played standard with some of the old guys, but what he loved playing best was the old slide tunes. Slide tunes.
One night, some white boys from a fraternity yelled forward to the stage at the black man holding the acoustic guitar and began to shout, "Play Dixie for us! Play Dixie for us!"
Daniel gave him a look, studied the big tooth grin, and then big shiny eyes, shook his puffy paste face, hovering over golf shirts and chinos. He looked from them to the uncomfortable expression on the faces of the old guys with whom he was playing.
And then to the embarrassed faces of the other college kids in the club.
And then he started to play. He felt his way slowly through the chords of the song once and listened to the deadened hush as it fell over the room. He used a slide to squeeze out the melody of the song he had grown up hating. The song the whites had always pulled out to remind themselves.
Mind themselves and those other people just where they were.
Daniel sang the song.
Daniel sang the song?
Daniel sang the song. He sang it slowly. He sang it feeling the lyrics, deciding that the lyrics were his, deciding that the song was his. Old times that were not forgotten. He sang the song and listened to the silence around him. He resisted the urge to let satire ring through his voice. He meant what he sang. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland.
And can we pause for 1 second? Sorry, our main actor is having a technical problem and can't get his script together. His online script is stuck. I'm sorry to pause this.
Rami, can you chime in until that's resolved so we can keep moving?
Sure.
Or I will.
Someone need to resend it.
Okay.
We're listening to a live radio drama of The Appropriation of Cultures by Percival Everett. Warts and all, here on this brave new world of Zoom radio drama. Perhaps we can pick it up with a reminder of he sang it slowly, meant what he sang, look away, Dixieland. When he was finished, he looked up to see
A room full of eyes on him. One person clapped.
Yeah. Another. Soon the tavern was filled with applause.
And hoots!
He found the frat boys at the back and watched
as they stormed out.
A couple of people near the door chuckling at them as they passed.
Roger, the old guy who played tenor sax, slapped Daniel on the back and said something like, "Right on," or "Cool." Roger didn't play the first few bars of "Take the A-Train."
And they were off.
When the set was done, all the college kids slapped Daniel on the back as he walked toward the bar.
Where he found a beer waiting. Daniel didn't much care for the slaps on the back.
But he didn't focus too much energy on that. He was busy trying to sort out his feelings about what he had just played. The irony of his playing the song straight and from the heart was made more ironic by the fact that as he played it, it came straight and from his heart, as he was claiming Southern soil, or at least recognizing his blood in it. His was the land of cotton, and hell no, it was not forgotten.
At 23, his anger was fresh and typical.
And so was his ease with it, the way it could be forgotten for chunks of time until something like that night with the white frat boys or simply a flashing blue light in the rearview mirror brought it all back. He liked the song. He wanted to play it again, knew that he would. He drove home from the bar on Green Street and back to his house, where he made tea and read about Pickett's charge at Gettysburg while he sat in the big leather chair that had been his father's. He fell asleep and had a dream.
In which he stopped Pickett's men on the Emmitsburg Road on their way to the field.
And said, "Give me back my flag."
Daniel's friend Sarah was a very large woman with a very large afro hairdo. They were sitting on the porch of Daniel's house having tea, and the late fall afternoon was mild and slightly overcast.
Daniel sat in the wicker rocker,
while Sarah curled her feet under her on the glider. "I wish I could have heard it," Sarah said.
"Yeah, me too.
Personally, I can't even stand to go into that place. All that drinking? Ugh, those white kids love to drink." Sarah studied her fingernails.
"I guess. The place is harmless. They seem to like the music."
"Do you think I should paint my nails?"
Daniel frowned at her. "If you want to."
"I mean, really paint them. You know, black or with red, white, and blue stripes. Something like that." She held her hand out, appearing to imagine the colors. "And I have to grow them long."
"What are you talking about?"
"Just bullshitting."
Daniel and Sarah went to a grocery market to buy food for lunch and Daniel's dinner.
Daniel pushed the cart through the Piggly Wiggly, while Sarah walked ahead of him.
He watched her large movements and her confident stride. At the checkout, he added a bulletin full of pictures of local cars and trucks for sale to his items on the conveyor.
"What's that for?" Sarah asked.
"I think I want to buy a truck."
"Buy a truck?"
"So I can drive you around while you paint your nails."
Later, after lunch, and after Sarah had left him alone,
Daniel sat in his living room and picked up the car sale magazine. As he suspected, there were several trucks he liked, and one in particular, a 1968 Ford three-quarter ton with the one thing it shared with the other possibilities, a full rear cab window decal of the Confederate flag. He called the number the following morning.
"And arranged with Barb, Travis's wife, to stop by and see the truck."
Travis and Barb lived across the river in the town of Irmo, a name that Daniel had always thought suited a disease for cattle. He drove around the maze of tract homes until he found the right street and number.
"A woman in a house coat across the street, watched from her yard, safe inside the chain link fence around her yard."
"Down the street, a man."
"And a teenager?"
"Who were covered in grease and apparently engaged in work on a torn-apart Dodge Charger."
"Mindlessly wiped their hands."
"And studied him."
Daniel walked across the front yard through a maze of plastic toys and knocked on the front door.
Travis opened the front door and asked in a surly voice, "What is it?"
"I called about the truck," Daniel said.
"Oh, you're Dan?"
Daniel nodded.
Yeah, the truck's in the backyard. Let me get the keys." He pushed the door to, but it didn't catch.
Daniel heard the quality of the exchange between Travis and Barb, but not the words. He did hear Barb say,
as Travis pulled open the door,
"I couldn't tell over the phone."
"Got him," Travis said. "Come on with me."
He looked at Daniel's Jensen as they walked through the yard.
"What kind of car is that?"
"It's a Jensen."
"Nice looking. Is it fast?"
"I guess."
The truck looked a little rough, a pale blue with a bleached out hood and a crack across the top of the windshield. Travis opened the driver's side door and pushed the key into the ignition. "It's a strong runner," he said.
Daniel put his hand on the faded hood and felt the warmth, knew that Travis had already warmed up the motor.
Travis turned the key and the engine kicked over. He nodded to Daniel.
Daniel nodded back. He looked up to see a blonde woman
looking on from behind the screen door of the back porch.
The clutch and the alternator are new this year. Travis stepped back to the wall of the bed and looked in. Yeah, there's some rust back here, but the bottom's pretty solid.
Daniel attended to the sound of the engine. Misses just a little, he said.
Yeah, tune-up will fix that.
Daniel regarded the Rebel flag decal covering the rear window of the cab, touched it with his finger.
That thing will peel right off, Travis said.
No, I like it. Daniel sat down in the truck behind the steering wheel. Mind if I take it for a spin?
Sure thing. Travis looked toward the house, then back to Daniel. The brakes are good, but you got to press hard.
Daniel nodded.
Travis shut the door, his long fingers wrapped over the edge of the half-lowered glass.
Daniel noticed that one of the man's fingernails was blackened. I'll just take it around a block or two.
The blonde woman was now standing outside the door on the concrete steps.
Daniel
put the truck in gear and drove out of the yard, past his car, and down the street.
Not a man.
And the teenager who is still at work on the Charger.
They stared at him. We're still watching him as he turned right at the corner.
The truck handled decently, but that really wasn't important. Back at Travis's house, Daniel left the keys in the truck and got out to observe the bald tires while Travis looked on. The ad in the magazine said 2,000?
Yeah, but I'm willing to work with you.
I'll tell you what. I'll give you 2,200 if you deliver it to my house.
Travis was lost, scratching his head and looking back at the house for his wife.
Who is no longer standing there.
Whereabouts do you live?
I live over near the university, near Five Points.
2,200, Travis said, more to himself than to Daniel. Sure, I can get it to your house.
Here's 200. Daniel counted out the money and handed it to the man. I'll have the rest for you in cash when you deliver the truck. He watched Travis feel the bills with his skinny fingers. Can you have it there about 4?
I can do that.
What in the world do you need a truck for? Sarah asked. She stepped over to the counter and poured herself another cup of coffee, then sat back down at the table with Daniel.
I'm not buying the truck. Well, I am buying a truck, but only because I need the truck for the decal. I'm buying the decal.
Decal?
Yep. This truck has a Confederate flag in the back window.
What?
I've decided that the Rebel flag is my flag. My blood is Southern blood, right? Well, it's my flag.
Sarah put down her cup and saucer and picked up a cookie from the plate in the middle of the table. You flipped. I knew this would happen to you if you didn't work. A person needs to work.
I don't need money.
That's not the point. You don't have to work for money. She stood and walked to the edge of the porch and looked up and down the street.
I've got my books and my music.
You need a job so you can be around people you don't care about. Doing stuff you don't care about. You need a job to occupy that part of your brain. I suppose it's too late now, though.
Nonetheless, Daniel said, you should have seen those redneck boys when I took Dixie from them. They didn't know what to do. So the goddamn flag is flying over the state capitol. Don't take it down, just take it. That's what I say.
That's all you have to do? That's all there is to it?
Yep. Daniel leaned back in his rocker. You watch old Travis when he gets here.
Travis arrived with the pickup a little before 4, his wife pulling up behind him in a yellow Trans Am.
Bob got out of the car and walked up to the porch with Travis. She gave the house a careful look.
Hey, Travis, Daniel said. This is my friend, Sarah.
Travis nodded hello.
You must be Barb, Daniel said.
Barb smiled weakly.
Travis looked at Sarah, then back at the truck, and then to Daniel. You sure you don't want me to peel that thing off the window?
Well, I'm positive.
Okay.
And Daniel gave Sarah a glance to be sure she was watching Travis's face. Here's the balance, he said, handing over the money. He took the truck keys from the skinny fingers.
Barb sighed and asked, as if the question were burning right through her, why do you want that flag on the truck?
Why shouldn't I want it? Daniel asked.
Barb didn't know what to say. She studied her feet for a second, then regarded the house again. I mean, you live in a nice house and drive that sports car. What do you need a truck like that for?
You don't want the money?
Yes, we want the money, Travis said, trying to silence Barb with a look.
I need the truck for hauling stuff, Daniel said. You know, like groceries and... He looked to Sarah for help.
Books, Sarah said.
Books, things like that. Daniel held Barb's eyes.
Until she looked away.
He watched Travis sign his name to the back of the title and hand it to him. And as he took it, he said, I was just lucky enough to find a truck with the Black Power flag already on it.
What? Travis screwed up his face trying to understand.
The Black Power flag on the window. You mean you didn't know?
Travis and Barb looked at each other.
Well, anyway, Daniel said, I'm glad we could do business. He turned to Sarah. Let me take you for a ride in my new truck.
He and Sarah walked across the yard,
got into the pickup,
and waved to Travis and Barb,
who were still standing in Daniel's front yard as they drove away.
Sarah was on the verge of hysterics by the time they were out of sight. That was beautiful, she said.
No, Daniel said softly. That was true.
Over the next weeks, sightings of Daniel and his truck proved problematic for some.
He was accosted by two big white men in a 72 Monte Carlo in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven on Two Notch Road.
What do you do with that in your truck, boy? The bigger of the two asked.
Flying it proudly, Daniel said, noticing the rebel front plate on the Chevrolet. Just like you, brothers.
The confused second man took a step toward Daniel. What did you call us?
Brothers.
The second man pushed Daniel in the chest with two extended fists, but not terribly hard.
I don't want any trouble, Daniel told them.
Then a Volkswagen with four teenagers parked in the slot beside Daniel's truck.
And they jumped out, staring and looking serious.
What's going on? The driver and the largest of the teenagers asked.
They were admiring our flag, Daniel said, pointing to his truck.
Teenagers were confused.
We fly the flag proudly, don't we, young brothers? Daniel gave a bent arm, Black Power closed fist salute. Don't we? He repeated. Don't we?
Yeah, the young man said.
The white men had backed away to their car. They slipped into it and drove away.
Daniel looked at the teenagers and, with as serious a face as he could manage, he said, get a flag and fly it proudly.
At a gas station, a lawyer named Ahmad Wilson stood filling the tank of his BMW and staring at the back window of Daniel's truck. He didn't look to Daniel. Your truck? He asked.
Daniel stopped cleaning the windshield and nodded.
Wilson didn't ask questions, just pointed at the rear window of Daniel's pickup.
Power to the people, Daniel said, and laughed. Daniel played Dixie in another bar in town, this time with an R&B dance band.
At a banquet of the Black Medical Association.
Strange looks.
And expressions of outrage.
Change to bemused laughter.
And finally to open joking.
As acceptance of the song was played fast enough for dancing.
Woo! Oh, now.
Oh, I wish I was in the land of cotton. Those old times they're not forgotten.
The song was sung slowly.
Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. In Dixieland, where I was born in.
To the profound surprise of those singing the song.
Early on one frosty morning, look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. I wish I was in Dixie. Hooray, hooray. In Dixieland, I'll take my stand to live and die in Dixie. Way, way, way down south in Dixie. Away, away, away down south in Dixie.
Soon there were several.
Many.
Trucks in Columbia, South Carolina, sporting Confederate flags.
And being driven by black people.
Black businessmen.
And ministers.
Wore rebel flag buttons on their lapels.
And clips on their ties.
The marching band of South Carolina State College, a predominantly black land-grant institution in Orangeburg, paraded with the flag during homecoming.
Black people all over the state flew the Confederate flag.
The symbol began to disappear from the fronts of big rigs and the back windows of jacked-up four-wheelers.
And after the emblem was used to dress the yards and mark picnic sites of black family reunions, the following 4th of July, the piece of cloth was quietly dismissed from its station with the U.S. and state flags atop the state capitol.
There was no ceremony.
No notice.
One day, it was not there.
Look away, look away, look away.
Actors Cassidy Brown, artist Fontaine, Sophia Frederick, Gwen Loeb, and David Moore read Percival Everett's 1996 short story, The Appropriation of Cultures, with music by Marcus Shelby. Our live radio presentation was directed by Rami Margron. Author Percival Everett is Distinguished Professor of English at the University of Southern California and the author of nearly 30 books. Among his many awards, the Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Dos Passos Prize, the Penn Center USA Award for Fiction, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. I'm pleased to welcome to our virtual stage via Zoom director Rami Margron and music director Marcus Shelby. Welcome to our interesting presentation of today's Corona Radio Theater, Rami.
Hey, David. So sorry. Oh, man.
Well, you know, it's the joy of live radio. I make no apologies for that. You know, there's something to be said for a live glitch.
Right. I mean, in theater, we love the mistakes because they put everyone in the moment, you know?
It does indeed. Well, tell us how you came across this story.
Well, I came across the story
because I heard the NPR selected shorts reading of it.
Well,
years
there you
and
go.
Ago,
shout
in the 90s.
Out for NPR right away. Okay.
Right?
It
yes.
Being California Public Radio Day, by the way. Right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I loved it instantly. Totally, totally. And then I messaged Sue or Joanne a long time ago and said, like, hey, there's this great story. And I think that someone had already suggested to him before me. And then years passed, and then they approached me about directing a reading for it. This is a few years ago. And then with most of the same cast. And then, and then we just put it back together for today.
And Marcus, I'm sorry we had a little bit of technical difficulty with the music you selected for Dixie appropriately in this tune. Is this anticipated being performed at a word-for-word live event at some point? Let's get Susan Harlow involved in the conversation.
I'm just going to say, Susan. Hi. Well, I want to hear what Marcus has to say, but let me just say that we love this story and we're enjoying what we're doing for you so much that we're going to start actually doing podcasts, recorded podcasts, which will be debuting on the 17th of September with The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster. And you can go to zspace.org/POD. But I want to say we love this story. And we asked Marcus to come on board to do just a little snippet of what he can do, which is what we heard, literally, a little snippet. But if we are able to do this as a podcast, which means a different situation with the rights, we would definitely bring in Marcus to do a lot more musical choreography, I guess you'd say. And Marcus, you can carry on from there for me.
Well, I don't have much to add other than, unfortunately, the music did get lost in the beginning and at the end. It really just was sort of a way to frame the this melody that we all know that's been associated with white supremacy. But, you know, seriously, I think Safia did a great job of claiming this piece and using sort of the sensibilities of the blues and how the blues can really show irony and show humor and show the dichotomy of tragedy and triumph. So for me, this was really about the process. The production didn't really happen. But the process was interesting to kind of learn how to think about. It's a very complicated issue. It was very even complicated to even be part of dealing with a song like this, which I have a lot of reservation because it wasn't something that we're reclaiming. It's not a song that I don't think Black people ever owned or felt any admiration for. But there's a larger, I think, possibility. Black people like my family are from the South, Memphis, Tennessee, Mississippi, other places now, born, raised, history is there. And I think that, not that that song represents that, but I think that the blues has been a way to explain our experiences, good, bad, tragic, or otherwise.
Indeed. And Rami, you mentioned that you heard this story first on Selected Shorts on NPR. It dates from 1996, but it's amazing how this could be read tomorrow or yesterday in South Carolina or any number of states. It's sad,
unfortunately,
but true. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
So thank you for bringing this to our airwaves, indeed.
But, back then it was more of a fairy tale, and now it has maybe bits of more truth to it as these Confederate flags and monuments start coming down.
Power of the spoken word, indeed. Thank you so much. Yeah. And to all the actors involved in today's performance. That was our Corona Radio Theater segment for this week. Again, thank you, Rami, for your direction, and Susan for your direction of word for word over these many years.
And Joanne, too. Thank you.
Next week on Corona Radio Theater, we'll continue our collaboration with the San Francisco Mime Troupe's Tales of the Resistance series and the continuing noir-style detective story of Jade for Hire.
Looking for work during a race and class war ain't easy, but why was Derek fired in the first place? And what is the secret of Jamazon.com? Find out next week in Jade for Hire. And if you're a fan of radio drama, be sure to tune in tomorrow night here on KALW for LA Theater Works. Judith Ivey and Matt McGrath will be performing A Fair Country by Jan Robin Bates. That's tomorrow evening at 8 here on KALW. I'm David LaTulipe. A reminder that today is California Public Radio Day, a special day when stations all across the state are joining together to ask you to show your appreciation for your nonprofit local station, warts and all, during this COVID crisis and the experiments that we're doing with live radio, especially here on Open Air. Now, you turn to your radio to help you get through your day, help it get started, perhaps stay in touch with the ever-changing news. Sometimes you might even stay in your car until a story or a song ends. Now, think of all the times you discovered a new piece of music or listened to music that put your mind at ease. These are the moments we cannot afford to lose. So today on California Public Radio Day, please support this local nonprofit station that is reliant on over 70% of its budget on individual supporters just like you. These are important moments, and they are commercial free moments. You can help make more of these moments possible for you and your entire community by contributing now at kalw.org. Well, one of the most difficult art forms that has had a long road ahead of it before fully integrating back into this new COVID reality world is ballet. The physical closeness of a corps to ballet, the proximity of dancers to a pit orchestra full of musicians, which faces its own unique set of problems. And of course, a future of socially distanced attendees are but some of the challenges ahead. The creative spirit has not died, however, as you've been witnessing in Open Air week after week. And you can witness from any number of local, national, and international companies who have risen to the occasion and adapted to virtual performances as the real drama of the coronavirus takes center stage. Those that have risen to the occasion include our own San Francisco Ballet. Among the creative output in these times of confinement, the company recently premiered Dance of Dreams, a new dance film directed by Benjamin Millipede featuring San Francisco Ballet dancers performing choreography by Justin Peck, Dwight Roden, Janie Taylor, and Christopher Wheeldon. Available now for viewing at sfballet.org. It was filmed in iconic San Francisco locations, including the Palace of Fine Arts and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. It's the new 6-minute film set to music of Bernard Herrmann from Vertigo, Alfred Hitchcock's San Francisco-based thriller from 1958, and played by members of the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra. I'm very pleased to be joined by a couple of creative types who make the ballet happen, both when it was actively happening to the public and now behind the scenes. One, a very familiar voice to Open Air, conductor Martin West. Martin, welcome back to Open Air.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me back.
And I'm very pleased to welcome for the first time Christopher Dennis, the company's production director. Chris has been with the ballet for some 10 years. He has a technical theater background and is also a lighting designer whose work is in the repertoires of ballet companies around the world, as well as for the Shaw and Stratford festivals. Dennis started at SF Ballet as a technical director and now oversees and is responsible for just about everything that happens on stage, with the exception of the choreography. Dennis, welcome to our virtual open airwaves as well.
Hey, thank you, David, and it's nice to be here. And I just want to say Christopher is my first name, Dennis is my last.
I'm sorry, I bet. Indeed. And if you prefer Chris, I'm happy with that.
That's
as well.
Perfect. Chris is fine.
Well, Chris, let's talk about some of the challenges you're facing now when you're not faced with a stage full of people. How is planning moving forward at the ballet?
Planning is a little challenging right now. We're dealing with coming up with a variety of different scenarios, one that may have us on stage, one that may have us outdoors. And so without knowing when we're going to get the full go-ahead, the scenario planning is very fluid, and we're just kind of taking it one day at a time. And right now we have our dancers back in the studio under really COVID guidelines, taking class. So that's the first thing that's happening.
And are you involved, therefore, in some of the behind-the-scenes productions that are being filmed for viewing now at SF Ballet?
Yeah, definitely. Right now we're looking at the potential of a digital season where some of our new works, we're potentially looking at creating films for them as we speak. But I was definitely involved in the creation backstage, or behind the scenes, I should say, of Dance of Dreams.
Tell us about that. So we had these dancers create these very brief segments. It's beautifully done, by the way.
Yeah.
And well worth a view at sfballet.org. Very beautifully segued brief segments where they're almost alighting to each other and taking each other's movements from each other as the scene progresses.
So the ballet was shot over 2 days, and through the fantastic work of our cinematographer, Joe Lindsay, and through the work of Brian Benson, who was a producer who was working closely with us, the locations were iconic, like Fort Baker. And, you know, under COVID, we were only allowed through the Department of Health 12 people maximum to be on set. So it was a very small crew, and we shot during the daylight, or at least during the day. And the dancers came in at the different appointed times, and, you know, we really gave it our best efforts during that time.
Well, I imagine in this sort of a production, you're not faced with the challenges of being a production coordinator. You don't have to be so much a bad cop as a good cop in terms of budgeting and making sure that these things don't go overboard.
Oh, definitely. It was a different experience from producing something on stage. There's a lot of language and technical terms that we use on stage that is slightly different in the film world. But I learned really quickly and adapted. There were some similarities in producing a film versus producing something live on stage. And, we just kind of went with the flow, and the technical aspects of it were quite simple. And the fact that there was no scenery except for the beauty of San Francisco, we weren't using extra lighting because it was shot during the day. And, the dancers wore their own clothes. So everything was kept in a very simplified manner. And the dancers who performed together were sheltered in place together. And we really adhered to all of the COVID-19 aspects. We even had a park ranger on attendance to help with crowd control and to make sure we were adhering to the COVID-19 guidelines that were set forth.
Mm-hmm. Martin West, as far as the music goes, incredible Scene d'Amour from Vertigo, Bernard Herrmann. Was that from a previous performance of the ballet, or was this created just for this performance?
It was just created for this performance, actually. We had not played that as an orchestra. So it did create quite a few sort of logistical problems getting it going. So I got a reference track from somewhere, and I created a click track for the orchestra to play along with. And I sent out all the parts to all the players with just basic instructions of how I'd like it to play. And they all sent me back their iPhone videos and recordings. And I ended up with like 150 different files of music. And I just started plugging them all together. I had 20 first violin parts, which I put them all together. And it was amazing, really, because when you hear them and they all sound so different and they're all recorded so different. And by the time I put it all together, it sounded like an orchestra. I couldn't believe it.
That's wild. So you're very much involved with the technical aspect of it as well, not just...
Yeah, it's completely new. I mean, there's nothing, something I know anything about, really. The only recording experience I have is from when we recorded our own orchestra, and I've watched the editors do their business on the computer. And so I just basically taught myself over the last, we've done like 4 or 5 projects now with the orchestra doing that. So I'm getting better at it. And it's very much, I should have some lessons really. Might make me a bit quicker.
Maybe talk to Chris on that one in terms of some of the technical aspects. Chris, can you give us a taste of what to expect in the weeks and months ahead at sfballet.org in terms of upcoming virtual productions?
Well, I know that we are looking at some of our current captures that we have in our archives that we might be able to show. But right now we've listed our season for performing on stage because we're being optimistic about getting on stage still. So right now that is our goal. Just in case, we are looking at what we have to replace that with if for whatever reason we can't get on stage to perform. And so some of what we're talking about is existing captures of potentially some of the same work that we would do live.
And I'm assuming some of that's going to be coordinated with what will now be a virtual edition of the Nutcracker. Martin, as was just announced, unfortunately, but inevitably, there will be no live full Nutcrackers this season, which is probably the first time since 1944 or so that's not happened. And I know that the public is being encouraged to visit the SF Ballet website to not only follow what's going on with the Ballet News for some e-news, but to participate in a survey about how we can all come together and share the tradition of the Nutcracker still during this time.
Yes, I know. I hope people have some good ideas. It's going to be very strange this Christmas. I first conducted Nutcracker 23 years ago, and I've done it, I don't know, at least 15 to 30 performances of it every year since. So I feel bad because a few years ago I said we should all have a sabbatical, but now it's happening. I'm feeling terrible about it. I'm a bit of a loss. I can't tell you how heartbroken I am not to be able to do Nutcracker this year.
Indeed. I know some friends, too, that are very dependent on the Nutcracker performances for their very livelihood to help them get through the rest of the year.
Well, we're all dependent on everything. Yeah, performing is everything to us, whether it's livelihood or not. I think it nourishes our soul as well as our pockets. So, yeah, it's tough times when we have to announce things like that.
Well, let's stick close to sfballet.org for learning more about what's going to be happening with the Nutcracker. We're going to go out with the beautiful Pas de Deux from Tchaikovsky. I thank you, Martin and Chris, for sharing a little bit of insight as to how we're moving forward in this difficult time.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
SF Ballet performances of the Nutcracker will be virtual this year, and you're invited to add some input by going to sfballet.org. I'm David LaTulip. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. You can send me a story idea for a future segment, david@kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show and Damian D. Minor for being in studio running the board. Can you stand a bit of good news during this crisis? Well, a good friend, very talented musician, Jason Pischkowski, a viola player who's been working with the San Francisco Youth Orchestra, has just been named executive director of the Santa Cruz Symphony, with also good friend Danny Stewart as conductor. So congratulations to Jason. It'll be a challenging time for you, both at this Youth Symphony and at the Santa Cruz Symphony, but we wish you the best. And again, thanks for listening to Open Air, and support us at klw.org.
You're listening.